Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lin, Kavi Razai, Lucia Milanig, and Bruce Alpert. Dan Friedel will tell us what's trending today, and later we will bring you this week's education report. But first, here is Brian Lin.
The United States remains a popular destination for immigrants from Africa, according to the U.S.-based Pew Research Center. The number of African immigrants coming to the U.S. has more than doubled since 2000, Pew said in a new report. The organization said that as of 2015, 2.1 million African-born people were living in the United States. That number is up from 880,000 in 2000. Back in 1970, there were just 80,000. Monica Anderson is a research associate at Pew and the author of the study. She said one reason for the large increase is that many immigrants are refugees from Africa. She noted that in 1980, only 1% of refugees admitted to the United States were from Africa. Today, that share is about 37%. That is one major factor that is driving the growth of African immigrants, but it doesn't tell the entire story, Anderson told VOA in an interview. She said that over the years, certain U.S. areas have developed large, established populations for African immigrants. One of those is the Midwestern state of Minnesota. The state is home to about 25,000 people of Somali origin. This is about one-fifth of the whole foreign-born population of the state. In different clusters in the U.S., African immigrants are really reshaping the immigrant population there, Anderson said. Another example is the neighboring state of South Dakota, which has large refugee communities from Sudan, Somalia, and Ethiopia. Overall, Africans make up about 15% of South Dakota's foreign-born population, according to Pew. The top states where African immigrants live are Texas, New York, California, and Maryland. African immigrants in the U.S. include tens of thousands of refugees from Somalia, Sudan, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Eritrea, Pew said. But it also includes highly educated doctors, engineers, and others seeking a better life in America. Randy Capps is the director of research for U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute. He said that as of 2013, 38% of sub-Saharan African immigrants had a bachelor's degree or higher, compared to 28% of all U.S. immigrants. But despite the increases, Africans still make up a relatively small amount of the total U.S. immigrant population. Capps said there are both historical and geographic reasons for this. It's a long distance from Africa, and the number of people in Africa with sufficient incomes to migrate that far has been relatively small, he said. He added that the path for legal African migration to the U.S. was not fully opened until the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. The act, signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson, removed immigration quota systems based on national identity. This allowed for immigrants of all nationalities to be accepted equally. The act also made it easier for skilled immigrants to migrate to the United States. I'm Brian Lynn.
Big data is having an increasing effect on the way we live. Big data can be defined as information that is too big or complex to be contained or processed by any one machine or person. It can include which comments, photographs, or stories you like on Facebook's website. It also includes seemingly harmless personal information that political campaigns use to reach voters. The presidential election campaign of Donald Trump used big data to reach American voters who normally would not share their opinions with others. It also helped organizers of the campaign to end Britain's membership in the European Union, known as Brexit.
John Kreisa works in London for Hortonworks, a computer software company that started in California. He says there are lots of ways to measure a person's feelings. One probably very obvious one is things like Twitter, he says. Social media, in general, is a way that people express themselves and express a like or dislike. By themselves, the trillions of bits of information would just be a collection of countless facts, many of which are considered worthless. But add the power of the human mind, and it is a different story. As a student at the University of Sussex, Julian Daly had two majors, English and philosophy. When he completed his studies, Daly wondered how he would ever earn a living in a world filled with machines and technology. Now, he is part of an industry that includes Google and Facebook. It is so large, no one seems able to estimate its worth.
Daly's research company, Morar Consulting, started 3 years ago with 5 employees. The company's earnings have increased by 25% each year. It now employs 90 people. What we ultimately do here is we try to discover what's meaningful for people, and we correlate that to their economic behavior, Daly said. He noted the importance of working with people with different skills. We have people from traditional research backgrounds, in addition to some in social sciences, economics, people from tech backgrounds, and salespeople, Daly said. Companies like Daly's employ recent college graduates. The industry profits from the ideas of these young men and women. New forms of data also make it possible for some observers to predict the future. They are more valuable to companies and campaigns than the traditional forms of record keeping, recording, or reporting data. We have access to the core information inside people's heads, Daly said. They tell you what people are going to do as opposed to what they've done. That helps people take preemptive action. This makes it much more useful for strategy.
The presidential election campaigns of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both used big data last year. Trump's aides employed a London-based company called Cambridge Analytica. It used a method known as psychographs. This method uses information about a person's behavior to influence their decisions. Cambridge Analytica also provided its services to the Brexit campaign. Both the Trump and the Brexit campaigns were accused of xenophobia, an issue many people did not discuss. Xenophobia is defined as the fear or hatred of foreigners. For both Trump and Brexit, opinion polls had predicted election day losses. But their victories depended on voters who had remained quiet during the campaign. Those voters may have refused to publicly state their opinions out of concern of being labeled racist.
Opinion surveys did not tell the truth, but big data did. Big data lets you document certain behavior and what people like, says Tamara Chahayib. She works at Scott Logic, a British company that advises software developers. Let's say, if you publish certain articles, follow certain people, she noted, that could give them an indicator about your views, and based on that, they could get a better indication about how likely you are to vote for someone or something. The possibility of having businesses read minds is frightening for some, and there has been pushback. Facebook, for example, has blocked the use of much of its informational content to non-users. The European Union has enacted some of the world's strongest privacy protections.
Supporters of the industry are ready to show that big data is a force for good. Lori Miles is director of analytics at SAS UK. The company assists the financial services company HSBC Bank. He says the ability to capture and process data in real time is important for protecting credit card users. Julian Daly dismisses concerns that computers have finally taken control of our daily lives. There's a moment of suspension of disbelief when we allow ourselves to believe that humans will be allowed to be replaced by machines. I think it's a fantasy, but fundamentally, they will always be plugged into the wall. They can be turned off. With that in mind, humans will still remain in control.
I'm Kaveh Razai.
And I'm Lucia Malanig.
In 1991, workers in New York City made a troubling discovery. They found human bones. After examinations by experts, the remains were found to be of African Americans, some of whom had been slaves. They had been buried in the 17th and 18th centuries. Now, members of Congress from the state of New York want a museum and education center built. They want to help people remember and learn about a very dark period in American history. The congressional members estimate that 20,000 people, men, women, and children, were buried at the place in the lower part of the New York City borough of Manhattan. After the discovery of the remains, the burial ground was declared a National Historic Landmark in 1993. A monument was created in 2006, and later a visitor's center opened. But supporters of the bill to build a museum and education center say more needs to be done so Americans will never forget about slavery. It was a period when people were shipped from Africa against their will, bought and sold, and made to work without pay. Many were separated from their families. Their contributions to America in the face of great injustice and persecution should not be forgotten, said Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York. Congressman Adriano Espaillat, another New York Democrat, agreed. It has been nearly 400 years since the first African slaves were brought to the United States, marking the beginning of one of the darkest periods of our nation's history, he said. Creating a museum and education center, Espaillat said, is a great way to examine the suffering and injustice slavery created throughout America. Michael Blakey is a physical anthropologist at William and Mary College in Virginia. He examined some of the skeletal remains that were found at the burial area. In an interview with Archaeology magazine online, he said that many people are troubled by human remains. But he said they can provide important information about the people who were buried, including the countries they came from. In the proper context, science can give the public a chance to get close to these people, he told the magazine. They stir things in us, many different feelings at once. I'm Bruce Alpert.
This is what's trending today. Last year, VOA Learning English wrote about a strange ice monster caught on video in Alaska. Many internet users thought a piece of frozen rope in a river was actually a monster, like the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland. Now, there is a new water-related mystery. Over the weekend, people on a Florida beach found a half-eaten shark. Officials in Volusia County said the shark was a blacktip, or spinner shark, slightly less than 2 meters long. People are trying to figure out what took a bite out of the shark. The county is home to the well-known Daytona Beach and has a large number of shark reports each year. The Orlando Sentinel newspaper reported in late 2016 three surfers in the area suffered non-fatal shark bites on the same day. Florida wildlife officials say two large great white sharks were seen in the area this winter. The sharks were a little more than 4 meters long. Many news organizations posted about the shark discovery on Twitter. Some comments on the stories included, "Just a reminder, there is always someone bigger than you." The Florida Program for Shark Research is part of the University of Florida. In response to the story, the program said, "It's a shark-eat-shark world out there." One Twitter user wrote, "Megalodon got him." Megalodon was a predecessor to today's great white sharks, thought to have lived many millions of years ago. And that's What's Trending Today. I'm Dan Friedel.
Women are underrepresented in the technology industry around the world. At colleges and universities in the United States, women represent only 1 in 6 students of computer science. That number is changing at some schools, like Harvey Mudd College in Claremont, California. The school is a leader in getting women interested in technological professions. At its robotics laboratory, a small robot performs the movements of Tai Chi, an ancient Chinese meditation exercise. Student Jane Wu writes commands from a nearby computer. With these commands, she is demonstrating a simple form of robotics and artificial intelligence. Wu is a third-year student in mathematics and computer science at the college. She says she decided on a career in computer science after taking a robotics class called Autonomous Vehicles. In the class, she and other students built robots that can act on their own without any human control.
And in that class, we got to make our own autonomous robots from scratch.
Harvey Mudd College has just 800 students. It was named after a mining engineer who helped set up the school. It is part of a group of schools called the Claremont Colleges in the eastern part of Los Angeles. 10 years ago, the college recreated its computer science program to make it less difficult for students without much experience with computers. The effort has produced noticeable results. Last year, more than half of the students who completed the program were women.
Students are first placed in groups based on their knowledge of computers to reduce their fear of technology. Many of the students later find that computer science is a beautiful intellectual discipline, says Professor Ron Libeskind Hadass, but also a useful one. All Harvey Mudd students are required to take an introductory computer class. That class fueled the interest of Veronica Rivera, who is studying computer science and mathematics.
It was a very balanced class, and I think the professors also did a very good job of making sure everyone feels welcome regardless of their coding ability.
Rivera hopes to develop computer programs to help people who have difficulty moving parts of their bodies. Women were well-known coders in the early days of computers when Grace Hopper helped invent programming languages. She later became a top official in the United States Navy. Jim Borkol is an assistant professor who supervises the robotics lab. He spoke to VOA about Grace Hopper.
So she is the original coder. It was only kind of in later decades, 80s and 90s, that computer games and kind of the idea of computer programming kind of got heavily marketed towards boys rather than girls.
At Harvey Mudd, some women who come to study engineering rediscover programming. Each year, many attend what is said to be the world's largest conference of women technologists. It is called the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. Amelia Reed is a computer science student at Harvey Mudd.
With coding, I can just have my computer, have some programming language I'm working in, and I can make almost whatever I want.
Reed is helping create computer apps to increase the productivity of workers and students. Internship programs are part of the training. Samantha Andow, a third-year student, is making plans to serve as an intern at Microsoft Corporation in the state of Washington.
I'm really excited to see all the problems that computer science is working on right now.
Maria Clave is president of Harvey Mudd College. She says computers are important to all areas of life, and the technology industry needs the best and the smartest. If we don't manage to get a more diverse community into technology, she said, we're not going to get as good solutions, as much progress as we need on the problems facing the world, whether it is climate change or education, or health care. Clave says today's issues need the creativity that diversity brings and that the field needs more women and minorities as future programmers. Both groups do not have enough representation in the technology industry, she says. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.